This is Hello Kopi Kemilu Podcast episode 55, and we have Dane Syed. Dane Syed is a is that how you pronounce it?
Syed,
right? Syed. Dane Syed is a Malaysian made filmmaker who, in my opinion, is one that has the most authentic perspective. Interchange, Bunuhan, Dukun, and one can only imagine what would be manifested next. That's how I would describe you. How would you describe yourself, and how young are you, Mr. Dane Syed?
I'm Moses' age, so I don't have a staff. I'm just shot below, slightly below Mahathir, who's of course Noah's age.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, I think the thing about the film industry is something that you can't help it, because I think I've been in the industry for maybe over 25 to 30 years, not counting when there was still a bit in TV and so on and so forth. I started actually, I suppose we were one of the early pioneers in terms of, you know, this, my generation and a few others who started in commercials. And that's where we got started. I was in TV, but I got dissatisfied and I thought there wasn't really, it wasn't going to get me. Well, it was at least the first stepping stone. Mm-hmm. And then I went on to do commercials, the next stepping stone. And then after that, we just decided, okay, we're just going to do film. That's it, me and my producer, Nandita. Yeah, so, yeah, I guess it was early days. It was the days when we were still shooting and making films with this plastic thing called film. The cameras were a lot bulkier, with a lot more weighty, and there's a lot more... It was a lot more difficult making films in those days. And then you have to remember, editing was also on the Steinbeck machine. Editing was non-linear, and even when we moved to video. So the whole thing felt like, I suppose, a craft, if you like. Simply because I think a lot of it is also sometimes you had to physically, like editing, you have to cut the pictures.
And it's like sort of making a cupboard.
It's hands-on, pretty much, yeah. And every little thing matters, especially in commercials. So, because film was expensive, and not only that, you can't see what you're shooting until you've sent it to the lab, which means that you've got to spend more money. And then you can see. And even then, you can only see it in this. Then you do a print. And then by the time the 90s came around, early 90s then, you have to feed it through a telecine machine, and then it comes out as electronic media, and then you can see it. Yeah. So the process was arduous. But what it did give you, I think, in many, many ways, which perhaps today, I think the very good kids and the very good people can, which is a kind of a sense of discipline,
right?
Because every frame mattered, every frame costs money.
Every frame matters.
Yeah, and every frame costs money. Yeah. So we are not the delete button generation. Mm-hmm. You can't just delete now, don't worry. Or the other generation, which is like, well, before the delete button generation, it was like, oh, we'll fix it at post.
Fix it in post.
Yeah, because everything mattered. You needed to see it, you need to spend money. Mm-hmm. And you can't waste that money.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
how does it feel like to sort of like have the recognition that you have today? Does it feel different with like Anugerah Screen 2018 and all that? Has that been the dream for you on your journey?
I think I didn't start off at your age. Yeah, I started very young. I mean, I didn't start off thinking, oh, I'm making films for awards. I just made films because I wanted to tell a story, and I just love film, the medium. I think that's how we all started, more or less, right? I mean, you know, every young person said, yeah, I've got a story to tell. Well, now everyone has got a story to tell. Not that everyone never did before, but they did. But because now you have much more access to the medium. So I guess it didn't feel so far away for most young people now. It feels still within reach for you to be able to just, you know, get a camera, shoot, and tell a story, you know? Yeah, so... What does it feel? I mean, it feels good, because I think the journey has been a long, arduous one. You know, your journey has never been a straight route, straight path. You just go this way, that. You know, I did a lot of traveling. Before I did a lot of travel, I did a lot of work, you know, raising just a bit of money to shoot a 3-minute film or a 2-minute film, you know, and even then you had to get inventive because you just don't have the money.
So was that in the early 90s?
80s, or late 80s, yeah.
You were in your 20s back then?
Yeah, I was in my 30s.
30s,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, so because I'd also like, long story, I'll tell you about it later. I had a very, unorthodox journey in getting through to education and getting to make films.
Do you remember the specific moment that you fell in love with cinema?
Yeah, I was
in your teenage years, if I'm not mistaken, right?
I was 7 or 8 when I saw my first. I was living in Egypt then, and we went to see. There were two moments. One was 7 and 8 when I was living in Egypt. Somebody I don't know who took me, my older cousin. Mm. We went to see a spaghetti western, and I fell in love with cinema then.
Okay.
But I already fell in love because I lived and grew up in Tumpat, and I remember in those days, this Chinese guys on the back of a van would go from kampong to kampong, right?
Right.
And they have this laya panchak, right? I think it's like they went and they tie a cloth between two trees or a pole, and then screen it from the projectors on the back of the truck, and they screen the film. But of course, the film is never the latest film because they just go around with whatever stocks that they have.
Do you have to pay for it? No, it's free.
No, it's free.
Okay.
So we'd sit there and watch in the field, you know, and it was really, really. I happened to meet once or twice because I didn't stay in this part of Malaysia, in this part of the world for very long, simply because my father worked a lot abroad. So I saw that in Tumpat. It was an old film that they had screened, black and white, and it was called Ben-Hur. So it was so exciting, and we just watched it as they screened this, projected it onto a cloth tied between two coconut trees or something, and it was, you know, and you just enjoyed it for the evening, you know.
Mm.
So that was the first one. Second was Stronger, I think, simply because it was in color, and you saw it in the cinema. And then I saw what happened was I was schooling with and my best friend was this kid, and his father was a huge film star in Cairo, in Egypt. And so the teacher managed to get him to ask his father if he can visit as a day trip for the kids to go and visit a studio.
Mm.
So we watched this film studio in Cairo, which was really fascinating. And that was also the second time I went, okay. But the real time was in London when I went in sekolah, because of some stupid lessons called Latin, and I
bought
things called
Latin is also in Egypt.
No, that was in London.
London.
So by this time I was in my teens, and I was kind of like bought things called go and watch cinema every other afternoon because it was cheap.
How does it feel like to be Din Syed with your upbringing?
What a question.
Yeah. I mean, apart from all the successes, apart from all this filmmaking, how does it feel like to have like so many environment bestowed upon you at such an early age, like constant change of environment? Does that make you confused or?
No, not at all. I think that's a really long, but it's also a complex story. I don't know how much of it you're interested for me to tell.
I mean, whatever
the viewers, the audience, but
whatever that you don't mind sharing, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
I grew up in many different cultures, so one foot was always straddling another culture, but I do think that we in Malaysia have. I'm lucky because later on, when I experienced that, when I was going to school with English people, I realized that we were much more at an advantage because a lot of them came from one place, spoke one language, and knew only one culture. Whereas I grew up a bit in Malaysia, and I listened and I heard the Cantonese, the Beatles in Cantonese. I heard Indian music and Arabic music, and I fell in love with all those kinds of things. And that stayed with me. And so it's a good question, the fact that I always felt that a lot of Malaysians, because of the makeup of the country and the identities and the many different races, we're always straddling different cultures, one foot here and another foot in another culture. And so, you know, and of course I speak English because my mother is an English school teacher, and English, you know, she spoke English really, really well. And even though, yes, part of my time I lived in Kelantan, Tumpat, and then another time, my mother's also from the heart of KL. Her people of original Kampung Bahru people. Yeah, so therefore they were Minang. And so, you know, so these cultures are already there for us to, in a way, experience. And it's extremely valuable, because I found that when I was living in England, a lot of those people, they were really quite kampung, you know? And even as I was growing up, a lot of Westerners and a lot of very kampung Malaysians were actually, because of also the colonies, because of post-colonial, a lot of people my generation, slightly before me and after me, also, we were sent abroad, you know, we were sent many places to be educated. And so while we understood and live our own culture, we also understood other cultures. And that was the one of the most valuable things. Did it make me confused? I don't think so. Because what it is there's two levels. So one is, I always wondered when I was growing up, because I already knew that I wanted to work in the arts. My own uncertainty was whether it was going to be literature, whether it's going to be painting, or whether it's going to be films. And I was, the heroes I love, they all had one definite thing. They were very definite about their culture.
Right.
So even when they rejected it as a form of self-investigation or self-awareness, whether it's people like Beckett and Joyce and those people who questioned their own culture and their own identity, they rejected it, some of them. I always felt like at least they had something to reject. I didn't even have anything to reject.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I always wondered whether that affect the way a poet, a writer, or a filmmaker, or a theatre playwright, that would affect the his view and his viewpoint on the world in terms of creativity. And I always wondered whether that lack in me would be a problem.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were you aware of this early on? Or?
Very early, since I was 15.
Right.
14, because I knew already that, because I fell in love. Literature basically was my first love. And I already toyed with the idea that, you know, but I felt so despondent. You know, read all these great writers, I could never be like that. So, you know, you write in secret. So, so already you begin to question these things simply because, you know, my mother was English, so she threw books at me. She allowed me to explore and really allowed me to grow with literature. And so because of that, I think you can't help but question these things, because they're part of your everyday world. So I was always in the library. I was always, you know, these are because I grew up quite a lonely childhood.
So you were the only child, I guess?
No, I had three sisters, but I was the only son.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I drink coffee.
Yeah. And then like Egypt, London, what's next? Where's next after that?
I don't know. I mean, like for me, I love, me and Nandita, we always talked about the stories we want to make. It's tied to the place we are from.
Okay.
So Nandita, as my producer, also had traveled and straddled many cultures, because, you know, her mother is also coincidentally an English school teacher. So while she was educated here, she speaks Malay fluently. She could write in Malaysia. And then, you know, she also then, you know, went to education in, but she always visits India, because apparently her mother is actually from India. And so then she visits, she was educated in the US, and then after that, did her MA in London. So many years, we kind of, from, I think as a matter of a life experience, as a matter of living, we all did. I bet you can ask many people in Malaysia, and they experience this what I call straddling of many cultures. So what next? For me, I can't leave Southeast Asia behind, because I know that there's such amazing stories and amazing lives to project and to depict, and the kind of stories that we want to get involved in is here in Southeast Asia, whether it's Indonesia, Singapore, Malaysia, Philippines, you know, and Thailand, for example. We border these countries. The thing is, we border, it's almost as if, you know, we're not bordering hard borders. Borders are never hard, it's always porous anyway. But because we're bordered by water, it's almost as if the water flows, the stories flow through this part of the world. And the stories are, of course, being the modern medium that film is, and that's what I love about it. We can tell our stories which are some of them are ancient and old, and they come from a place which some of us, even people living city dwellers, are forgotten or don't think it's important enough, and you mix in that with film.
Yeah. But I guess your perspective is more concrete. It's because like you have left Malaysia. The perspective of when you lose something, you will actually be grateful for it. Like when you leave your country, your own country, you will be grateful of where you came from. Because like most of the people my age in the 20s right now, we are sort of looking to the West, and maybe in the later years we will go back to our roots and see where we're coming from, but we are more inclined towards idolizing the West. Maybe it's because we haven't explored enough out there to appreciate where we are from. Do you agree with that? Because you left quite early, like you get to reflect on what I had, what you had prior to that.
Well, I think you hit the on the nail, but I think it's, I mean, you're right, but I think it's what aspect of that. I give an example. You say that, you know, your generation and the younger people now idolize or look to the West, but it's not so much because you are. I don't think the lack or the inability to appreciate your own culture is because you are idolizing the West, but I think it's like this. I think for a large part, the educational system, I mean, it has to be back down to education. They don't really teach in depth the history of your own culture. Like, for example, even literature does not connect anymore to the history of this country or your own culture. Right? By that I mean, what's being taught in literature now, they don't teach the older literature anymore, right? So how do you connect the past? How do you connect who you are? So there's no layers of meaning, there's no layers of an appreciation of the depth of which your own particular culture and its origins or its source can come from, right? One. So when you don't have that, it's easier for you to switch and to look at another culture. Even though I can dare say you don't even know that culture in depth at all either, right? So a sense of history has been lost, a sense of stories, how deep your stories can go, is lost. So what matters, and why it's great for people to be embraced across cultures, what film is about, but at the same time, there's another aspect of it, which is sad, because you lose any sense of perspective of who and what you are, and most importantly, you lose perspective or you lose any credible connection with your own stories.
Yeah, I feel you. I understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because you know, if you've only been bred on McDonald's, that's all you're gonna be looking for. It's just different variations of burgers.
I guess you just have to taste more, like get out there more.
That's one thing. But it's not just that. I think you need to effectively really find something for yourself to dig deeper, and really be interested in certain things which I think it could be a seed, right? Because look at it this way, Milo. A film is a film is a film, right? An action film is an action. A horror is horror is horror. But what makes it really different, right? The Koreans can add whatever it is in any genre, because genres transgress or crosses cultures. There's a good and bad thing about genre. Right. If you study art and you work at it really, really well and work really hard at it, you can turn it into something really, really different. But a lot of people take the easy path because of two things: the lack of knowledge or awareness of your own identity in your own culture, and the idea that it's easy because we just look to the West. So it becomes, the danger of genre is, if you do it and you really go deep and cut and do something different with it, or, and that's good, or it just becomes a cookie cutter. Acuan.
Yeah.
Wak Kuih.
Yeah.
Right?
It's very preset, pre-made.
Preset, you know already. Like this, the arts, the three art structure, this happens, this happens at this minute. This, it's just, you know.
Mm.
Yeah. And so, you know, like it's, that's, and we mustn't forget the problem with the camera, the problem with cinema and the camera and the cinematic technology is because not only does it look easy, it is easy. Can.
Okay.
You pick up a camera, you shoot.
Yeah.
But that's the same like writing.
Mm.
Everyone can write, but not everyone's a fucking writer. So the pen is a 20th century punya, the camera is a 20th century punya pen, right? But like I said, you can do that, but it doesn't make you a filmmaker. That doesn't make you a writer if you just because you can write a sentence or 10 sentences, right?
Mm-hmm.
It all has to do with the craft, with the art and craft of storytelling. Mm. Really, at the end of the day,
I guess, yeah, with storytelling, yeah. With filmmaking also, like people think like filmmaking is so cool, or you are a creative person, you are an artist. But what they don't know is filmmaking is not all just about the story. It's also about the pre-production, the recce, the people management, all these tedious things that is not too exciting, right? And you obviously have to go through that,
yeah.
The process.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What do you think? What would you say to these young filmmakers who are just about to get started, like, or they have a camera and they feel entitled to, like, oh, I want to tell a story, but it's just more than that, you know? It's the people that you work with, the collaboration, the casting, a lot of stuff, even the funds, like the loans that you borrow, right? It's more than just, oh, a movie, wow, it's you won an award. It's a lot more than that, a lot more in depth, right?
Yes, it is, for sure. I mean, but at the same time, that's the wonderful thing about filmmaking, is that it is accessible to everyone, but it's still really, really hard to be really, really good. It's easy in a way. You can say you can just take a camera and a bunch of friends and create a story, right? And go out there and you can go on a shoestring budget, but you can't keep doing that as a career.
Mm.
You can do that first, second, third, but it just things become, how should I put it, your stories expand, your vision expands or grows, and you want to try out a different thing, and you know. And so you arrive at a different place. When you get to a different place, you never arrive fully, but you get to a different place. And then you have to try and do something else. It just grows, your imagination grows. I guess it is easy, but it's not, right?
Hmm.
Because at the end of the day, I just came back from a meeting, actually, and the way that technology is going, it will definitely change and take on many different aspects and dimensions in terms of what the camera and camera can and cannot do.
Hmm.
What the camera now is not less what it cannot do, it's less more what it can do with the coming technology. Which when I say coming, it's already here actually. But the only thing that stops us from getting to it is actually it's expensive technology. I'm talking about whether people are matching it with AR and VR and so on and so forth.
Yeah. Let's go back to the question of what would your advice be for young filmmakers, though? Should they get on marinate your ideas first, or just go with it? Like, because life is short, do as much as possible. Or like, what would your take be of advice with the beginners out there?
I think, you know, like if you look at the history of a lot of the history of cinema, and you look at the careers of a lot of filmmakers, a lot of them actually started their film on whatever, in whatever ways that they can. Yeah, whether it's Scorsese in his first few films, before he made Taxi Driver, he did, or even Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. I think he did that. But he started even a bit. I think he also went to the Roger Corman, if not one film or two films, and many others, which is the Roger Corman is the El Cheapo way of making films. But a lot of really good directors went through that. Hmm. That's West Coast. So I may have got it wrong, but I'm sure I'm not Martin, because Martin Scorsese is on the East Coast in the US. And so everyone started somewhere with low budget and with small budget films, whether it's David Lean, who shot his Eraserhead at weekends, whether it's, I can't remember names, what? He did? Huh? What? That's what I said, Lynch. No, I said Lynch. So anyway, well, Lynch did that when he was working in the fish and chip shop, apparently, and then he raised enough money and shot that. And now, so everyone started somewhere with a small, low budget. But like I said, it's always, you can't keep doing that for 30 years because you get older.
Mm.
And as you get older, you need to feed people.
Yeah.
People work for you. You can't keep asking to do things for free. You can't keep asking to do things for no budget. You know what I'm saying? And so, yeah, and the stories probably get more and more elaborate. Because then the technology was, you know, there were different grades and levels. That now, your GoPro can take, it's an 8K, 4K, so what the hell? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, but still, you still need to think about, you can. But the thing, I don't know anyone else really, a filmmaker who does everything by himself.
Mm.
Even if you can, there's still the acting. You still need actors, right. You know, stuff like that. So yeah.
So I guess in a way that you're telling them, find people that has similar interests and then work with them. Is that what you're saying?
And I think, you know, to answer your question, yes. So you did mention, would you advise them to go ahead and just go ahead and do it? And yeah, go ahead and do it. Just make your film. But also, you must also be really aware. You can't just make something and not know the context, the history, the formula, the culture, and so on, so of your medium. Unless you're an utter genius and then you come up with something really amazing and you know the history and the language of cinema inside out, and you can just, you know, produce works of genius every time. But I think you do need to at some point be aware that when you make your film, you make your story, if it's good, if it's not good, so on and so forth, and it becomes a learning process, and where do you place yourself in that, and how and what is your medium, you know, the craft, basically, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Do you think filmmaking is fun? Or, you know, perhaps do you agree that it is fun and then it is difficult?
It should be fun.
Okay.
It should be fun.
Right.
But there are only moments of fun for me. A lot of it is just hard work.
Hard work.
Yeah, hard work and sometimes really extreme. I mean, it's funny. My sister said to me, "You really got your work cut out for you, Dane." I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "It's emotionally taxing, mentally tiring, psychologically draining, right? And emotionally, really, difficult on many levels." I mean, like, for example, you know, when you reach a certain place, a certain level, where you have to work on the script, you have to write the script, so writing itself is a long process. Once you've done that, you have to raise the money. Once you raise the money, and that may take anything from 3 months to 3 years. I've got projects I've been working on for the last 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years. Right? So, you know, and then when you're dealing with money, so then you have a good producer who helps you to deal with that. But then you're on set, you're always running and working against time and money. Then it's extremely taxing and draining, because you're under pressure a lot of the times.
With those difficulties, have you ever felt like you want to just stop and perhaps get on another journey, change path?
It's funny, actually. I mean, sometimes it gets to, because it's funny. I don't know. I encountered this in Malaysia, but I've asked other people, and someone says, "Then it's everywhere like that." But I think it's degrees. And what I'm about to say is, to answer your question, is the problem with here is a lot of the times you have to deal. So you have to deal with the problems and the hard fight of actually creating and making a film. But unfortunately, you're also dealing with bullshit. That's the part that sometimes really gets to you. And you have to deal with people that are not necessarily pleasant. Mm. That are really unpleasant people out there. And that's the kind of thing that, and sometimes it's the system also they have to deal with, and that system isn't set up to its most optimum, right? To help create creators, to help people create, they almost put that as stumbling blocks. So I guess half the times you're dealing with things that's not in your control. If things are in your control, that's not the problem. You can work and graft at it as much, and you can bleed, you know, and you can bleed and come near to death's door. But that's not a problem, because you get satisfaction of actually creating at the end of it, right? But it's the bullshit that you unfortunately that you have to deal with, and it comes almost in equal measures.
Yeah. Yeah. See, have you ever felt that, like, I'm done with this bullshit?
Of course.
Yeah.
I'm done. You think I haven't? This is like, fuck am I doing here with these people? I mean, like, you know, it's like, you know, I mean, of course, the saving grace is because I think I'm appreciated by a lot of my audiences, or really young people. That's the thing, I guess. So young people come up to me all the time, actually, and really say some really, really lovely and really encouraging things that you think, okay, you can. But sometimes I do come across days when is it really worth it, you know? Because before long, it infects everything that you do. It's the people with and things that are, or they bring bad energy, or they bring different kinds of things, which at the end of the day, actually what you're doing is you should be happy because you're creating. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
So it's sort of like, instead of being happy of by creating, you are actually burdened by it and becomes a chore.
Yeah, it's
right. That is when you feel like fuck this, right?
It's funny, actually. Yeah. In many, many ways. I mean, like I said, I think it depends where you are in many ways, and it depends. I don't want to focus on it too much either, because I've learned also over the years through my best friend, my producer, my partner, Nandita, it's taught me to learn how to let go, simply because it's not the end anyway. And the thing is, when it was in many ways more fun and easier, not easier, but more fun, when you were struggling to achieve those things. But once you achieve, you come to a different set of problems.
So problems are inevitable, but you would appreciate the struggle.
Yeah, but the thing is,
it gets addictive.
Problems are fine if they're to do with creative problems.
Okay.
If to do with the kind of problems that you have to deal with in terms of what you do. But you don't need the bullshit. What I'm saying is, sometimes the bullshit that comes with it is just like really, really incredible. You know what I'm saying or not?
Yeah.
And so all I'm saying is, everything we hear, even when you're creating and you have problems at scene number 23. And what's the problem there? It doesn't feel right, or it doesn't feel honest enough, or it doesn't feel, there's something not quite there and that's lacking. You can deal with that. And that is a struggle, but it's a worthy struggle. It's a worthwhile struggle.
Yeah.
But assholes and, you know, fuckwits, you know, they're the kind of people that destroy everything for you. Yeah, or at least they try to.
Yeah. So as a writer, right, when you write your stories, do you have actor in mind, or do you usually cast them after the writing is done?
It depends. I mean, it depends on the story, Milo. I mean, for me, it's like, it's both. Sometimes, or like some, when I did Bunuhan, I kind of know who can visualize who my characters are.
Okay.
Interchange Aku too, and Dukun. And sometimes there are characters I don't know how to see this person. So there's two kinds of I don't know. One, I don't know the character that I'm building, and that's a problem, so I need to work at it. The other is I don't know the character to the point that I can't put a face to it. That's slightly not so difficult, because in a way, that's just about casting and meeting the right people.
Mm-hmm.
But when you don't know the character that you're creating, that's much more of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes, happily, when you get into rehearsals and you meet actors, and that's what I love about wonderful, wonderful actors, because maybe you have a hint of you may know, or sometimes you don't know, you meet the actor and
you find
he defines it.
Mm.
Or he takes that character, or she takes that character and makes it what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it's a combination. You think you know, then they take it. You tell them what you see and what you don't quite know, they'll bring it alive.
So there's nothing personal there. The character, I mean, the actor has to suit the character that you write. You don't usually judge, you don't gauge an actor's qualification to be in your film based on their acting skills, per se? Or is it, do they have to have the right charisma for it?
I think all those things matter.
Charisma. Yes. Okay.
I mean, sometimes people walk in a room, you think, like you know how we discovered Jolo?
Mm.
We wanted these two guys, because I'd seen their film, Budak Kelantan.
Okay.
I'd seen Ware's film, so I wanted Ware to meet up. Ware, I don't know, I never met him. But I thought the film had a certain energy.
Mm.
It had flaws, but it had a lot of energy that I liked about it, and certain truths that I liked about it. It was rough. But when he came with Jolo, who's Shairi Hussein. And he just came, they started talking. Because I wanted him to translate to also be the language coach, because they're both he's from Kelantan.
Cool.
So when they brought Shairi Hussein here, then we talked and he left, and I just turned to him, as soon as he shut the door, I said, Nandita, that is fucking Jolo. Right, and you just know, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, it's the same when I had Pekin walked in. Pekin walked in for a smaller part. He came in because I was looking for smaller roles. He came in, went and talked to me. And as he sat and opened, even when he stood there, came in, I just thought, okay, who the fuck is this guy? Then he opened his mouth. Then he said, I'm Kelantanese. Then he spoke. Then we discussed. I said, thank you. I couldn't offer him any other part except with a small part. I said, shit, like, why didn't you come earlier? So, but we had a fortunate thing. Something happened, and immediately when that happened, I just called and just said, I just called my AD, line producer, and said, you get Puckett, bring him here immediately. I just said, I want you to do this part.
Okay. Yeah. Well, so that's how it is.
Some things you know, some things you don't know, some things you kind of like, or they come together. It's like with the interchange, I just kind of knew that I'd like to see how Idil can fit or not fit. Because, I mean, like, half the time, like, for example, the character of Idil in Interchange, I wanted it to be quite an existentialist kind of character, withdrawn from the world, seen far too many bodies, because he's a forensics photographer, and he was going through some kind of problem at the time. So I characterize it as too much dead bodies, too much, so it's numb, he's numb and he's distant from the world, so he might even have crashed. So when we meet him, he was kind of recovering, but not. So he, as a character, I define as somebody who is trapped by photography.
Okay.
Then he meets Eva, whose tribal beliefs is you take a picture of them and their souls will be trapped in the photograph. So he is trapped by photography, she is trapped in the photograph.
Yeah.
Right. And so for me, that became an engaging way to look at the two characters, right? And so for me, again, so when I saw that, but you must also understand culturally, you know, like if you read Murakami and you read European literature is in abundance. Right? Existentialist character displaced, distant in the world. You don't get a lot of that. Maybe it's like we're in the tropics in this fucking hot water. That we're
you don't get a lot of that here, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Name me in literature.
Yeah. I guess.
Name me.
Nah.
You can't, right?
Yeah.
Name me. Name that in any Southeast Asian. Because it's a hot country, people love music, they eat, there's none of that. You won't get a Nick Cave character in this fucking like country, right?
Yeah.
You know, so you needed. So the easy shortcut reference would be I say to you, yeah, just go and read Albert Camus, right? Mm. The French existentialist writer, and read, you know, L'étranger, yeah, the stranger. But you can't have a shortcut. You can't say do this or read Colden, you know, Catcher in the Rye, Holden Caulfield, right? You can't. So the only other way is you need to really work it out with the actor. What, who, and what is this character? How do you express it within a tropical environment,
mm-hmm.
which is lush and rich,
mm-hmm.
With the jungle is teeming, you know, it's like the edge of the forest. You've got like, you know, insects are crawling. It's just teeming with life.
Mm-hmm.
Cold existentialist characters, you know, live in cold countries.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They don't live in hot countries, I don't think. Or if they do, we need to find a different expression for them, right?
Uh-huh.
And what is that and how is that?
Mm.
You know. So yeah.
I guess the existential, it's in our heads, most of us, but it's just not expressed yet.
Exactly. So when it's not expressed, there is no cultural narrative for that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't exist out there culturally.
Yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh.
So how then you discover it? How do you dig it out? How do you define it? And so that's why I think, you know, some people may not like, I mean, I know, yeah, whatever, but I think, you know, for me, I'm very grateful. I think Idil did a great job. And at least in the opening moments, which is all I wanted, was to see him distant, to see him slightly, you know what I mean? This otherworldly kind of character.
Yeah. You discovered him through theatre, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, I did. Yeah?
Which play was that? Is it Disco Baldi? No.
Yeah, I had seen him in Disco Baldi. How did I see him? Disco Baldi, but I think, was he in a short film?
Hmm.
I can't remember, but I think it was theatre for
okay.
sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd seen him. Idil. Prisia, I had seen her in Sang Penari. And of course, what's his name? Nicholas.
Hmm.
I just Nanita said, "Who do you want?" And I said, "I want this guy."
Cool.
Nanita was like, "Huh?" I said, "Yeah, because I said he's too beautiful. I wanted to uglify him. I wanted him because the idea of the beauty and the beast, because he is the beast.
Mm.
He transformed into this beast-like creature,
right.
which sucks blood and helps the shaman to kill in that ritual. Yeah. So you know, like." I guess when you create, you create upon ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. From ideation to first day of shooting, how long did it take for Interchange?
Oh, Interchange, it took a few years.
4 years, 5 years?
Yeah, maybe 4 years.
And the filming?
The actual idea itself came maybe 5 years before that. But the actual real thing that came in, I started writing somewhat story flow, was maybe 3.5-4 years because I was supposed to edit and do some post work in Bangkok on Bunohan, but what happened was there were some problems, so they got pushed back, but I was already in Bangkok and so luckily we didn't have to spend so much because I was in a friend's house and she said come and stay, and she works in the corporate world, so she had like this huge massive apartment in near Bangkok Interchange.
Mm.
So she had 5 bedrooms and said she's constantly traveling. She said, just use my apartment.
Cool.
So I just sat there and like over there was this huge Bangkok Interchange. So I just put Interchange at first just as what
and
the title.
Stuck on.
It just stuck, you know. Yeah. So and so and it is about change. It is about interchange between one, I suppose, character to another, species to another, and the idea of interchange of cultural interchange, you know, stuff like that. And so that becomes a kind of metaphor at many different levels, and that's why we are okay about, yeah, just leave the title. It was, because in the beginning it was, we couldn't find a Malay title for it.
Right.
That's the only thing, because you can have interchange, but then you can change it, but then we didn't have it in the, how do we make the Malay title, you know? So then it just got stuck. Yeah.
How long did the filming take?
Filming itself took about maybe slightly more that I think than normal. We would normally shoot 4 weeks and a bit, but 4 weeks, but we did maybe 5 or 6 weeks.
5 or 6 weeks. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Just a sidetrack. What is Dane Syed's deepest fear?
Oh dear. the deepest fear for me are practical ones, because maybe I'm not really, how should I put it? Okay, I've never lived my life with fear. Nothing I've never done. I mean, I ran away from home. I ran away from school.
Cool.
I did what I fucking wanted to do. I didn't care what anyone said. I didn't care what my parents said. I just did what I wanted to do. So pretty much I lived my life. But then as you grow older, it's funny, it's strange, ironically, because I went through moments of fear, and that wasn't good. And that was dealing with assholes in the industry. But I'm no longer in that place, so thank God. And so, but that's not real fear. For me, real fear is when you face things which are a lot to do with who and what you are, you know, and whether you can still do what you do, whether things still, whether you can still create and bring out certain things, whether you can continue that, which is many ways your own legacy, your own belief, your own, how should I put it, innate ideas about the world and how you express it, you know. So I think those are, if there are fears. But the other, it's just, you know, for me, the practical things, whether I can get a fucking boat to the island, because I used to, my parents and family, we used to have a house in Prince John. Whether I can, I do think about it, because I know, because my mother was always so scared to go to the islands as she got older, because she said, if anything happens to me, how do I get back to the mainland? Will I get back in time? Blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know.
I guess we humans, no matter how mature we get or how long we've been on this journey as a human being, we still have the same fear, the same going somewhere and being afraid of not coming back, not being able to come back.
Yeah.
A sense of it's a little bit of existentialism as well. Once you cross that path, like the Neil Young song, once you're gone into the black, something like that, and you can never come back.
You can
right.
Come back.
Yeah.
Or Ted Hughes, I think in his poem with the horses, once you enter the tundra and you've seen these amazing things, you can never come back. Yeah. There's many ways you can't unsee it.
Yeah, it's sort of a curse of knowing. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. It's a curse, but at the same time, it may be the most beautiful thing, but it's also a curse because you can't go back.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, you're right. So, I mean,
That's it. That's that. Okay. With mental health, how does one creative keep themselves from going too far into the black hole of like exploration? You know, maybe we hardly see it in Malaysia, but let's just say as an independent soul who wants to discover the world, how do you stop yourself from going insane?
It's funny, I said that's an old world question, I call it, but you know, you're very young, so I don't know how you got into that side of it. But
some say I'm an old soul, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you know, is like, The act of filmmaking is extremely difficult in the sense, and another sense, which is the act of creating it, is because it takes so long. So the question is one of, on a more practical level, although it's never just that, is how do you sustain an interest? How do you sustain, how do you have and keep a stamina? You can have passion, but how do you keep that stamina for 3 years on the same, or 4 years on the same bloody subject? Right? It's not the subject, it's the characters you build. You know, sometimes now it happens a lot faster. I look at something, then I have to return to it, and I'm kind of dread returning to it because that thing has become, it's like it's been too long. But then once I get in, then there's an excitement, and then I have to break off again. And I think if the breaking off, you know, takes more than, normally it takes more than 3 days, it's really difficult
to get back to that
state. To get back to that place.
Yeah.
But you just have to, and that's the tiring part. And I don't know how damaging that is, actually.
To the mental health.
To the mental health. Yeah. And also to your own psyche, because it's like you need to be refreshed every time.
Mm.
But every time you go there, it's less and less.
Mm.
Yeah? It's like also, I suppose, you know, musicians would face, if you play for 30 years the same fucking music on stage, how do you keep making that fresh?
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? And so I know that from musician friends who say, now, how do I make this fresh? How do I, because you know, I wrote the song, blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, that's one aspect of that question, which is related, but it doesn't answer your question completely. What was your question again?
How does one stop themselves from going too deep?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not really from going too deep or something else. You
like
mentioned.
Like crossing over too far, going too far, in the black hole.
That. Yeah, because I think it depends. I mean, for me, when you say black hole, if you mean inactivity, if you mean you get to a place of so-called infamous kind of like a black hole of what's the word? Writer's block.
Mm.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Then for me, I have many different strategies. But I don't know whether the strategies that I develop consciously or they're just something a part of the process, which is I believe in research, I believe in writing, I mean rereading. I believe that when I'm researching, I also like, it's always adding. And the more you research, the more you read, the more you do other things to feed your mind. Sometimes I take a break and read something else. Because there's no, I don't believe in this thing. Or maybe I'm not aware of it because it comes in different way or different form. I don't believe in this kind of, I wait there for the muse.
So
yeah, am I allowed to smoke in your...
Yeah, you can. You can.
Okay.
Yeah.
So okay, cool.
If you could have a cup of coffee with any dead rock stars in this world.
Dead rock stars?
Dead rock stars, yeah. Who would it be and what kind of conversation would you have with them?
Well, it's Hendrix.
Jimi Hendrix.
Cool. Or Miles Davis.
What kind of conversation? Sorry, if you mind if I close this a little bit.
No.
Yeah. What kind of conversation will you have with them?
What kind of conversation? I think I'd like to have a conversation about many. With Miles, I think it'll be about history, music, where they're from, because you know his life was so fraught with so much, all kinds of issues, and he's got issues outside in terms of his society for his blackness. And the music and the kind of things that he had to face, and then really more than anything also is his music and how he developed the kind of, because I think he's like the Picasso of music.
Mm.
Because at every part of his career there's always a threshold in the way that the music changes.
Mm.
You know what they say about Picasso, right? He opened the door and closed it behind him.
Oh. So it's a little bit... Oh.
So it's like, anything you want to do, it's been done by Picasso. Anything you want to do, it's been done by Miles. So it's like, in a way, what I'm saying, that's what they mean by he closes the door.
He's done it already.
Right. I think that's what it means. I think Hendrix is fascinating because I don't see his music as just rock.
Hmm.
It's actually really extremely inventive. And it's almost like a shaman.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's not, it's magic. It's not like, he's more than just a musician. It comes from some other place. It comes from everything. It's so instinctive. It's so emotional. It's so what's the word? It's energy, and it's ideas, and the feel and emotion of it all just comes together, and it comes from many different places. I don't see him. It's like a magician, you know. He's not some bloke which is like a musician. I say a magician, so it's not music, it just comes there, he plays, and then, you know what I mean? That's it. It's almost as if this boundless energy which comes from places out larger than himself, larger than anything. And I'd like to know what that is, actually, and talk about him. It comes, of course, from his path, because when he was growing up and all that, and in his youth, I'd like to know actually how did he arrive, or what made him who he is, you know, because of his musicianship, which isn't kind of musicianship, it's more than that.
Hmm.
Yeah, the other place, people like that, is actually Coltrane for me.
Cool. Alright, this is where I flip the script and let you ask me any question that you have at the back of your mind, anything at all that you're curious or you want to ask me about.
Sean, yeah. So heavy this thing. Where'd you get this? How much did it cost?
This is 800 ringgit.
Well, it's not bad, actually.
Yeah.
I guess, what's interesting in terms of people like yourselves and younger people and what they're doing now is the interfacing between design, internet, and many other aspects of what makes up the internet and film and storytelling.
Mm.
Yeah. And music. How? Because it all seems that one person is capable. It's like a one-man show.
Mm.
Can do it, actually.
Okay.
So my question then becomes, for you, maybe you have friends, either they work together or friends who are capable of doing a lot of things together. How do you see that happening? How does that happen? How do you see that moving forward in the future?
The ones that are doing it by themselves alone are not doing it intentionally.
Hmm.
Some are because of their own personality that they are not very comfortable of being with other people. The introvertness, yeah, of them, the character that they have.
Hmm.
Or some just, they don't know how to mingle with anyone else.
Yeah.
And the fact that the knowledge is on the internet right now, everything is just, you can just, how to shoot a video, how to get this lighting right, how, yeah, to get this, yeah, scene more intense. And everything you can just, yeah, it's just, it's on YouTube, right?
Exactly.
So yeah, that is why it looks effortless, mm, because we have a reference point,
mm,
and then you are allowed to make mistakes. Yeah. You are allowed to create and press delete and re-record.
Yeah,
yeah, that is why.
Yeah.
But in the long run, I think now at this moment, 2019, I see that more people my age, younger generations who are in their 20s, are starting to collaborate,
yeah,
more, yeah, than it used to.
Yeah.
So that's good in a way. But how it's possible, I guess, it is because of the internet, but at some point we will run dry as well, because the fun comes with collaboration,
mm,
with meeting a new people and, mm, getting, like, breeding a new idea out of,
yeah,
two,
yeah,
human beings, two characters. Yeah.
And to me, I think from what I see, that is one of the wonderful things about, and not just filmmaking,
mm,
because the conditions within which we make films in my generation to yours has changed, because, mm, yours involve a lot more than just, they are all makers themselves, whether they're designers, whether they're sound recorders, whether they're sound artists, whether they are architects, whether they're design, whatever it is outside,
mm,
of, it's not necessarily confined within the filmmaking community or world only, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when we collaborate before, it's always to a certain degree people within. Mm. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Within film.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, it changed slowly towards it. That's why I also used to do a bit of, I did a video art installation. But it, I think particularly in parts of the 90s, late 90s, I think, and early 2000, the noughties, there were people working, for lack of a better word, as collectives. Not that the collectives didn't exist, they did. But they did in a very much more concentrated ways. That is, they came from the same background, or the same place. There have been collectives like that. but I see more and more from the noughties onwards, a kind of interfacing or interaction between different forms or disciplines,
mm-hmm.
working with filmmakers and music, for example, mm-hmm. and design.
Yeah.
I guess that to me is a wonderful thing. I think.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. How do you feel from your perspective, looking at through the '20s and nowadays, like the younger generations? Are we doing it wrong, or are we going somewhere?
I don't know. It's hard for me to judge because I think, like any generation, I think you'll have the pros and cons. You have the bad side and the good side. I think the good side. Let me focus on that. I think the good side is actually. They are turning and taking technology and working with values which either have been perennial or they still exist, but or taking values from the past and transforming those things in either different products or different expressions, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
Whether it's fashion, like for example, okay, let's make sustainable clothing. Let's make sustainable fabric.
Mm.
In other things, whether it's taking waste products, what can we do with those waste products? So in a way, I think there was generations before us, or my generation, so on. We fought on at ideological levels,
right?
Whereas your generation fought at the level of hands-on and making things and doing things and making things happen.
Right.
Whereas my generation, slightly before me meant the 60s, 70s, and me, late 70s, 80s, it was like still trailing in the wake of what are essentially ideological battles between left and right, between culture and counterculture, alternative culture, always an ideological level in terms of theory, in terms of, you know, all those things. When there are street demos, it's for values. There are sit-ins, demos against the Vietnam War, against whatever, Nicaragua. But the way that the younger generation are thinking about globally is also, it's a very strange thing, but it's also quite a good thing. It's public, it's global, but it's personal.
Mm.
Right? In the sense that it starts from the personal. It starts with, let's maybe I do this and maybe I get a few friends and we do this as a collective.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There was no such thing as social entrepreneurship in many ways. Right? There was only communes, which were like hippy-dippy and they wanted to do different things. Yes, there is. But I think what lacked it maybe was the fact that there was no... It shifted from being at the periphery to much more in a sense central in terms of what young people in their lives, what people's, how it affects and what they do in their lives. It's become central. They're not so far in the periphery of society or the margins of society.
Mm.
And that has a lot to do with the fact that you have access to technology. Right?
Yeah.
Because the technology can actually spread these ideas and these actions very quickly.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
And so when, you know, like when somebody does sustainable fashion, for example, I say fashion because I've been thinking a lot about wanting to, it'll never happen, but I wanted to make my own clothes.
Cool.
And then I thought, what if I made it with a certain fabric, right?
Mm.
I'm not going to go into details, but that fabric may have to do with fabric which is from tribal origins, or how tribal people actually made like those fabric from barks of trees, from whatever the process, maybe rediscover those processes.
Mm.
Yeah. Even if it's only as an idea, and even if it's only an experiment within a small period of my life, then it becomes really something that I think could could teach me a few things. You know what I mean? I could not, I mean, it's too late in the day for me to suddenly just say, yeah, let's do this on a big scale and I get involved in it. Who knows, maybe I can. But at the same time, when you look at printing technology and 3D printing in architecture, right? And so what's to stop you making waste product from rubber, from whatever, tires? And then how can we then turn that, right, into, for example, design for aspects of architecture or the spaces that we live in? Like, for example, I saw recently they've made from waste plastic, they've made roads out of it. And these kind of things which I think your generation, right, are thinking about. Right? And so it's very much hands-on, it's very much active, it's proactive. And it's not merely at an ideological level or front. That's, I think, one of the...
The execution.
Yeah. It's execution. It's collective. It's community. Those kind of things. And a lot of it has to do with the spread of that, with the accessibility to
technology.
Yeah. Really, you know?
Well, do you know, like, why do you think P. Ramlee is as... why is he being put in a pedestal to where he is today in Malaysian cinema? Do you think he is overrated or underrated?
I'm not one of those people. Actually, I don't know. I got slammed for this maybe, but I think he had his place, and he had his place in history, and he had his place, and he had his moment. But I think we do tend to prolong that moment. And I think that says more about us and our problems than it does about P. Ramlee. Yeah. Because I did a year of looking at Indonesian history, film history, and Indonesian filmmakers. I was funded by the Nippon Foundation. They have phenomenal filmmakers. Phenomenal. From the 40s, 50s, 60s. I dare say maybe even from the 30s. This is incredible, actually. They kind of went downhill after the... In the 70s, 80s, 70s, a lot more porn, and 80s, because I think Soeharto took over, and kind of like a lot of the period of flowering, renaissance of sorts of Indonesian culture, which was always socio-political as much as cultural in Indonesia. It was so advanced in terms of the social and the political and its articulation than we ever were. Yeah. Well, at least did not take the kind of expression here that it did in Indonesia, you know, its articulations. And so therefore I think our reliance on P. Ramlee is almost not just because it's good, but it's because of the other surrounding socio-political factors such as lack of freedom of expression and censorship and so on and so forth. So it's almost as if when you're not given or encouraged the opportunity to actually go beyond something, you always look back to a certain nostalgia. So nostalgia is a weapon of authoritarian regimes, right? And fascism, because so long as you don't have hope for the future, you look back. Because back is a myth. Back. Looking back becomes a kind of mythological self-referencing or self-celebration that can keep the population happy for a while.
Right. It's almost like we're running out of content.
Yes, because it's not that we are unable to, but if you don't give the opportunity, nor create the platforms, nor create the opportunities for which your people can continue to create, in a kind of pick up the mantle, the legacy that P. Ramlee had left behind, right?
Mm.
Then there's hope and there's opportunity. But that's why they go back only to nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very dangerous thing. It's not a good thing, right? So it's not P. Ramlee's fault. This is the conditions and within which the system was set up. Right?
Yeah. Okay. Wow, that's a good answer. Like, what would be the best piece of advice you've ever received throughout your lifetime to date?
Yeah, from my father, who once said to me, let me lead that up with a reason first when he said it. Well, you grew up in Egypt. And my father always said, then, it's not you can't touch the dog. You can't touch the wet part of the dog. And he said, it's probably because then, in those days, rabies must have been rife. So for everything that you read, or that you know, people tell you, whether it's spiritual faith or whatever, always look for a reason. Because the greatest gift God ever gave you is your brain. So don't just believe.
Because we're giving the akal to think.
Yeah.
But
people don't want to. I mean, it's like...
Yeah, to weigh it out ourselves, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean... It's the same as I grew up in Egypt. I remember, you know, I was playing football in Segambut. I was 3 or 4, I mean, before we moved out. I fell while playing football and I touched dog shit. So I went to the back of the house and I took some sand. I was doing this and my father opened the kitchen door, which led to the garden in the back of the house. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm up and doing dog shit. So he went back, hang on, he went back and he got a bar of soap. He said, use this, it works.
Yeah.
But then, you see, the problem with all this is very simple. I remember traveling, going through, we were kids and we were going for holiday and to Alexandria from Cairo. And we stopped, because there was a man and a camel.
Mm.
And the man was... My mother saw that he had a gazelle. Later we bought it from him. She loved animals. A gazelle is a deer, a small deer.
Yeah.
And so we waited, because he was taking his ablutions. And he was taking his ablutions completely with sand. And so we stood there for waited. He prayed. And after that we told him we bought it. But I went later in the car, my father said, do you notice what he was doing? I said, yeah. Do you notice what was on his camel? I said, yeah. I said, what? I said, bags, goatskin bags. And there was condensation. And water was dripping from it.
Mm.
So he only used sand, yes. Because it's the niyat. Because when you live in the desert, you do not fuck with water, ever. And that's one. So how do you disentangle what is religious and what is Arab culture? You live in the desert for hundreds, centuries. It's part of your culture. You move from one watering hole to the next. That's part of your culture. So which part is religion? Then you want to go, oh, ni religious tak boleh tak jamah atam, apa ya? Jamah anjing tak boleh ni. It's like, and that's what I mean when my father said, use this. And we used to fast in Egypt. During the summer, the sun rises at 5 o'clock in the morning. It sets at 9:30 at night. My father at 7:30 would say, come, let's eat. I said, yeah, tapi maksud, So according to the Quran, anyone, or according to the faith, ulama, so anyone can become a Muslim. So what happens if you live in Norway or near the Arctic Circle?
The sun doesn't fucking set. Just use this lah.
Yeah. It's the idea of fasting. It's not to torture you, right?
Yeah.
It's to make you more grateful for what you have.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's in the spirit of the faith.
Mm.
So you asked me that question, what advice, you know, the last, it's what my father taught me. It's the same that when you create, right? Because the act of creation and creating, I believe, comes from the same spirit. Yeah, the act of living, right? And even many different forms of energies that we hold that comes from us, right? Right down to sexual energy is an act of creation, right? Love is an act of creation because it's giving.
Mm.
Right? And so, to me, there's something quite almost religious when you see people who work so hard at writing, the suffering, at painting, the suffering, to get to a certain kind of truth. It's the same with belief. It's the same with love. It's the same with sex, actually. The sexual act to procreate.
Mm.
Right?
Mm.
And so these people, like, they talk about, oh, religion is all part of one, you know, it's all life, part of life, but they don't really act like that.
Yeah, they don't.
They don't. They separate and use only what suits them.
Yeah.
At the right time, the right place, particularly those who use politics.
Yeah.
As means to power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Cool. At the end of the day, when it's all said and done, how do you want the human beings on planet Earth to remember you as?
Yeah.
The day inside of. Yeah. How do you want the world to remember you as?
Milo, why are you doing this? This isn't really all really heavy questions, but I'm like,
yeah.
I'm not really like, you know, I'm still very new, you know. I'm not
Because I feel like. I can imagine time. Have you heard of this song "Time in a Bottle"? Right. This is actually a moment documented to look back 20 years from now when it's all said and done. I'm conscious of what's gonna happen. I look 20 years in time.
Yeah.
You will be a Piramli 20 years in time. You may not see that now, but I feel it.
Yeah.
This is it. Having this conversation documented is the gem.
Thank you. I mean, I don't know. I can't. It's not for me to say, right? So, but the thing is, I mean, I feel that, I mean, thank you for saying that, but I don't know. I mean, maybe it will not change. Maybe it will stay that way, because I think the problem is that things change. They're changing all the time. Mm-hmm. So to the point where the idea of a Piramli, the idea of a Kurosawa, kind of school, the idea of is it still possible to have the proliferation and the growth and the blooming and the way it's growing, media and how we're approaching media and the technology, would it still be possible to have, you know, in my generation, and when I was growing up, it's like the school of the films of Alfred Hitchcock, the films of Kurosawa, the films of Ingmar Bergman, to see a body of work like an oeuvre, or like you can see a definite and defined style.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I there was a point in my life when, you know, many few years back, I was saying, is that still possible? Would that ever be possible?
Mm.
When image is flowing and just being output, so much of it, is that still possible? Because the technology has moved so fast, styles change so fast, styles have become normalized, styles and ways and approaches of storytelling have become so ready-made, so
at hand, right? That is it still really relevant or possible to look at it in that way? I don't know, you know. So, you know, to respond to what you were saying earlier about me. That's all. Yeah. And yourself, but in this kind of climate and this kind of environment, obviously you are, I don't think you're only interested in image making. I think you're interested in many other things, right?
Yeah.
Your age and your generation. How do you see, one, yourself and your progress from here onwards? And how do you see that in relationship to your community or your generation? Are you going to be, do you have any particular trajectory or particular direction that you think you may want to move or carve out for yourself? Or is that going to be any more, if, I believe it's difficult for your generation. It gets more and more difficult.
Yeah.
Even though the access to technology is there, it's more difficult to carve out your own niche, and it gets more difficult to carve out and bring out what is your own, if you like, vision of the world, an expression of the world.
Because I guess it gets too saturated these days?
Exactly. That's right. One of the problems, or one, not problem, but one of the reasons. And the other one is, I think, you know, that's why I'm interested to know is like, then how many, not just you, but of your other, your friends and other people of your generation, if you ever talked with them about this, I don't know, do they talk amongst themselves about this? How do they see what's coming, or where they, and how they will, where they will be in the future? It'd be quite interesting. Because I don't think it needs to be somebody, you need to be in a great, you're a great person or a great man for you to be able to legitimately ask that question.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, for if the question was directed to me, I guess I would consider myself a thinker in general.
Yeah,
the difference between one person like me and another person in their 20s who are not going through these thoughts, they are just covering themselves up in like sort of avoiding that conflict, in facing what's coming on the future.
Yeah.
So I guess it doesn't help thinking about the future too much, but it sort of gives you a direction, like which direction do you want to go on.
Yeah.
But it still, it can create a different level of anxiety, because the future is really scary in a way. It's hard to make a name or even make a living for yourself.
Yes.
So that is why it's scary, but not many are actually consciously thinking about it.
Yeah.
When the day comes, they will just have to deal with it. They will just have to face it. But from a perspective of I'm 26 this year. From a perspective of a 26 years old, I think I can just take it a day at a time, a project at a time, and hopefully that it compiles up to the catalog that I have dreamed it to be. But right now the struggle, as you were mentioning earlier, the creative hurdle is like trying to get people notice that, hey, I can actually act, I can actually do this, because like obviously people like Idil, Zahirul Azim, they came from the same struggle.
Yeah.
And then they got their big break with the likes of you discovering them, right? Yeah. Discovering them through Aswara, which I went through the same journey. So yeah. I guess that struggle that every young individual face, they want to be heard, they want to be, they want their talent to be seen. That is where I'm at right now. But in the long run, it's about, okay, maybe at some point, maybe in 2 years' time, I will be discovered, and then what's next? Or maybe I want to create something, and then what's next? Maybe a family, and to try to instill the philosophy into my kid, like OS, the programming, like, okay, I hope you would not be scared of this world, because this world is kind of fucked up in a lot of ways. And then after that, maybe give back, or maybe Dean said help me. Now it's trying to help that 20-year-old in 40 years from now. It's about giving back, and hopefully the cycle continues and Malaysia will nourish in its own way. Yeah, that's how I see it.
Well, it's been interesting actually talking with you, because I think, you know, and I think not least because, you know, you are a thinking person, but I think also your questions are sort of like
triggered a lot of things in my mind. But I think, you know, more than anything is the question of the current contemporary society and your generation. I think that's really also an interesting thing, you know. To have talked about. Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much for agreeing to be part of this podcast.
No, thank you for asking. Actually, yeah. I don't know. Sometimes I'm just like, oh no, sorry, I'm too busy. But it's, I don't know the way you came up to me and you talked. I thought, oh, that sounds, it looks interesting.
Hello. Kopi ke Milo?
Coffee, any time
of the day. All right. Yeah. Thank you. Cheers, thank man. You so
thank
much.
You. Thank you, Milo.
Appreciate
thank
it.
You so much for talking to me.
Wow, that's incredible. Yeah.
That's good.
Hello, Kopi ke Milo podcast. Milo Fico, signing out.